being used for good, if it was being used to teach kindness or to help kids with their emotion regulation skills or their psychological development, I think that at the very least, we should use this amazing profit that social media companies have amassed to teach kids how to use their platforms in really beneficial ways to get the most psychological good to come out of it, and maybe even to create modules or experiences that we know could train kids and prevent them from mental health difficulties.
And Emma, you talk about logging off. You founded the Log Off movement, but you're not completely logging off. So what do you say to young people? How can you do it in any kind of healthy way?
What I say to young people is you need to mentally log off and reflect back on your own usage, asking deeper questions. Why am I on these platforms? Who do I follow? What makes me happy? Where am I harmed? And in answering these questions, young people can begin to curate their experiences online for themselves, to prioritizing their safety, their well-being, over other companies prioritizing the maximization of our attention. It is all about placing levels of friction between us and these addictive technologies. And that has to be facilitated through self-reflection.
Emma Lemke, we want to thank you for being with us, founder of Log Off Movement, Josh Golan, executive director of Fair Play, and Dr. Mitch Princeton, chief science officer at the American Psychological Association, professor of psychology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, you can call 988. That's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
Thanks for listening to KVOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kvoo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a winter storm is approaching Oregon and southwest Washington. We'll have those details. Vancouver cops start wearing body cameras on patrol. And in national news, we take a closer look at the Ohio train derailment and how residents have been impacted. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 20th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Well, keep those coats and boots handy. Winter isn't done with us yet. Oregon and southwest Washington can expect serious winter weather this week. The Cascades and Oregon Coast Range are expecting snowfall, and the National Weather Service has issued a winter weather warning. Wind gusts are a big factor, too. They're expecting gusts up to 45 miles an hour forecasted starting this evening. Portland and Salem could see snow on the ground by Wednesday morning, according to some estimates. It's not clear yet from weather models which areas will get snow and exactly when, but Thursday temperatures will drop into the low 20s. Portland has potential to break a record for the coldest daytime temperatures on Thursday and Friday. Cold weather all week also means if lower areas on the I-5 corridor do see snow, it will be sticking around for a while. Elsewhere in the United States, the upper Midwest is expecting a massive winter storm and serious snowfall as well. That storm also has the potential to spread an icy mix of showers from Nebraska to the New England coast. So if you're traveling, you can expect disruptions thanks to a blanket of snow in the middle of the country, on top of the winter storm warnings in our own neck of the woods. In other news, Vancouver police officers are getting fitted with body cameras for the first time today. That program is starting with patrol officers, but the department says everyone will have one by March 9th. After that, they plan to adopt new cameras on patrol vehicles as well, but that part has been delayed because of supply chain problems and shipping issues. The Vancouver community has been calling for body cameras on their police officers since at least 2019. That's when police fired on people four times in a span of just 5 weeks. Three died from those shootings, two were people of color, and one was a homeless man believed to be in mental distress. City leaders gathered a task force to rewrite police department policies in 2020, and the body cameras were one change that came out of those. It took until September of 2021 for city leaders and the police union to agree on how they'll be used. Vancouver Police's adoption of body cameras is in contrast to how a similar push has played out in Portland. Portland is the only city of its size that does not require its officers to wear body cameras. Body cameras for police officers have been a reform that people have pushed for since at least 2014 as part of a settlement with the Department of Justice that found Portland police used excessive force against people experiencing mental crises. Currently, Portland police union leaders and city negotiators have entered arbitration, which means they are at a serious impasse. The union wants its officers to be able to review the footage from their body cameras before they file a report about use of force. But the city and the Department of Justice don't want that. Both sides agree that watching the footage before filing a report where use of force was not an issue is okay. Negotiations now go to a state arbitrator, which could take 6 to 9 months. Today is the one-year mark for the Russian war in Ukraine, and the Biden administration says Russia must be held accountable for crimes against humanity. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley on 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We know the legal standards, and there is no doubt these are crimes against humanity.
Vice President Kamala Harris is making clear the U.S. position that Russia will be held to account for war crimes in Ukraine. She spoke at the Munich Security Conference Saturday. Top Republican lawmakers are now calling on the Biden administration to send fighter jets and more missiles to Kyiv as the war approaches its one-year anniversary. Democratic Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan tells CNN that if Congress is truly America's house, then Americans deserve to watch what happens inside.
What the American people were able to see unfold on the floor was a good thing for our democracy and our republic, right?
Following the captivating and unusually close coverage of the House Speaker votes earlier this year, C-SPAN is asking that its cameras be allowed to more freely follow action on the floor. Opponents say that would lead to grandstanding. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham tells ABC News he has no concerns about the testimony he gave to a Georgia grand jury or where that probe might lead.
The grand jury analysis that there was no widespread fraud in Georgia, I agree with that.
Graham was subpoenaed by the grand jury investigating former President Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 presidential election loss in the state. The grand jury recommended prosecutors seek indictments for perjury, but offered no indication of who may have lied in their testimony. Michigan's Christina Karamo, who refused to concede her 14-point loss for Secretary of State last year, will now lead the state's Republican Party for the next 2 years.
Governments have done atrocious things to their people. Are you that naive to think it could never happen here?
Karamo touts numerous conspiracies and ran for office on unproven claims of voter fraud surrounding the 2020 presidential election. Karamo told party delegates the GOP is dying. President Biden calls the internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II one of the most shameful periods in American history, calling it what happens when racism, fear, and xenophobia go unchecked. Yesterday marked 81 years since the executive order sending the citizens to the camps, as described in a 1943 U.S. government film.
We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal.
Budget analysts say a new program providing medical care to veterans exposed to toxic burn pits could add $800 billion to the debt over a decade. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the Honoring Our Pact Act will account for more than half of a deficit projected to spike to $1.5 trillion. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Headaches and lingering chemical smells from a fiery train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, have left residents there worried about their air and water. Nadia Ramlagan spoke with a chemical spill expert who explained that the actions currently being taken in Ohio are very similar to what's happening at other hazardous waste contamination sites around the country.
Experts say the long-term impact of the chemical spill in East Palestine, Ohio, will depend in part on how fast and thoroughly cleanup occurs. At the derailment site, workers are already moving contaminated soil as deep as 7 feet near where the rail cars burned. Purdue University professor Andrew Welton has dealt with chemical spills for more than 2 decades. He explains water will also be drawn out of the creeks for cleaning.
That water is contaminated, and it will be sent through devices called air strippers. And these devices help cause these chemicals that are in the water to go into the air so that they're not polluting the water anymore.
He says groundwater monitoring wells will be installed and then samples will be taken to figure out if there's any contamination. Welton notes that the heavier the chemical, the slower it degrades and the more likely it is to stick to soil. These compounds can remain in the environment for years if left unaddressed. Welton also points out that when government officials show up and do testing, they don't always test for the right chemicals. He believes the lack of scientific data available in the aftermath of the February 3rd disaster leaves many questions unanswered regarding immediate and long-term health risks.
For this disaster, agencies have been slow to share their testing data. For example, none of the drinking water well testing data is posted online. So it's unclear what officials are testing for.
Welton says it remains unclear how much of the toxic spill went into storm drains, was flushed down the streams, or may have settled to the bottom of waterways. He says that while only a handful of chemicals have been reported in the spill, potentially hundreds or thousands of volatile and semi-volatile organic compounds have been created.
What I would tell people that are affected is that it's their responsibility to ask questions and demand that the questions be answered, because officials and agencies sometimes do not act in the direct interest of the people unless they're given guidance by the people and their elected officials.
Over the weekend, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced that FEMA is deploying a senior response official along with a regional incident management assistant team to the region. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
The Georgia Supreme Court is hashing out the constitutionality of the state's six-week abortion ban, but Democratic lawmakers are not waiting around. They've introduced the Reproductive Freedom Act in the Georgia legislature in an attempt to repeal that ban. Danielle Smith has the details.
Reproductive rights groups are supporting legislation to restore abortion access in Georgia. The Reproductive Freedom Act was filed to appeal House Bill 481. The state's six-week abortion ban, as well as certain other abortion restrictions, opponents say are medically unjustified. Rula Ibi Samra with the Amplified Georgia Collaborative says current state law bans abortion after embryonic cardiac activity is detected. She calls the law misleading, saying there is no heartbeat at the six-week stage of pregnancy when the ban is in force. She says the new legislation would guarantee abortion access.
The Reproductive Freedom Act is our vision for what abortion access would look like in Georgia if it were truly accessible and truly equitable to get affordable care in your own community that was of high quality, respected your dignity and your autonomy to decide for yourself.
She notes Georgians who are at least 6 weeks pregnant currently have the option to go to other states for an abortion, including Florida, North Carolina, and for the time being, South Carolina. Five other nearby states have already banned the procedure. The Reproductive Freedom Act has three main components. They include enshrining in the law that anyone who is pregnant has the right to decide if they're going to continue their pregnancy. It repeals some restrictions to care that pro-choice advocates say are medically unnecessary. And IB Samra says it expands access to care by expanding the kinds of insurance plans that can cover abortion.
For example, currently because of state law, state employees' health care plans are not allowed to cover abortion. Obamacare plans sold in Georgia are not allowed to cover abortion, even though it's a federal program.
IB Samra adds, now that the federal protection of Roe versus Wade decisions are gone, it's up to the state lawmakers to decide whether Georgians have reproductive care rights, and if so, to affirm those rights. Amplify Georgia Collaborative is circulating a petition on its website in support of the act, which has been filed as House Bill 75 and Senate Bill 15. I'm Danielle Smith, Georgia News Connection.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with author Mel Gertov about his new book, Engaging China, Rebuilding Sino-America Relations. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, National Love Your Pet Day. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 44. Tomorrow, cold and rainy again with a daytime high of 46, turning even colder on Wednesday. And we do have a winter storm watch in effect for the Cascades.
Well, today is not just President's Day. Also on this date in 2007, the United Nations decided to observe the World Day of Social Justice each year on February 20th. It's an international day that recognizes the need to promote social justice, including efforts to tackle poverty, exclusion, gender inequality, unemployment, human rights, and social protections. The quote of the day is from American social reformer and abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who died on this day in 1895. Douglass said, quote, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will." The native community of Tyanek in Alaska says they were shut out of a new local land management plan. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska Native community of Tyanek is pushing back on its inclusion in a local planning group that makes decisions about land management, but which they say formed without their input. Riley Board with KDLL reports.
Tyanek is a remote, predominantly Native community on the west side of Alaska's Cook Inlet, across the water from the state's population centers of Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula. While the community falls under the purview of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, it's culturally and geographically distant from the borough's other communities. That's one of the reasons residents are objecting to their inclusion in a new planning commission based on the other side of the inlet in the predominantly non-Native community of Nikiski.
When somebody talks about that few of people determining that they'll have a huge voice in land planning for 3 million acres on the other side of the inlet, that just seems inappropriate.
That's Stephen Piskoski, CEO of the Tyanek Native Corporation. He says the Planning Commission does not represent the residents of Tyanek and was formed without its knowledge by residents in Nikiski who wanted more of a voice in land management and permitting decisions. Proponents described Tyanek as, quote, Nikiski's backyard, where its residents hunt and vacation. Piskoski says that notion is offensive.
The villagers from Tyanek and some of our shareholders, they were highly offended by that because they don't see it as a vacation land. They see it as a land where they do their subsistence living and where they've been living for hundreds of years. It's not a vacation land in their eyes. It's their home.
Some members of the borough's governing body were sympathetic to Tyanek's concerns, but ultimately the assembly was split on whether to remove the community from the Planning Commission's boundaries. The assembly will reconsider the plan at a meeting tomorrow, where Piskoski says Tyanek residents are planning to turn out and testify. Dozens of Tyanek residents and several Native entities have already submitted letters in support. For National Native News, I'm Riley Board.
Dr. Boo Nygren has passed his first 30 days as president of the Navajo Nation, one of the largest tribes in the United States. President Nygren says he's already fulfilled one of his campaign promises by lifting COVID-19 restrictions, fully opening the Navajo Nation. The tribe was still under COVID-19 mandates when he took office in January.
We lift the mask mandate because I felt like it was about time. All the surrounding communities have reopened. All the surrounding cities have reopened, and we just put precautionary and made it optional for people to wear a mask.
Nygren says he's met with the governors of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The Navajo Nation is located in the three states. He's also met with U.S. lawmakers and made his first official visit to Washington, D.C., where he attended President Biden's State of the Union. Those helping him lead the Navajo Nation in his administration are a number of Navajo women, including his vice president, Veterans Affairs director, and chief legal counsel. Vice President Rochelle Montoya made history in January, becoming the first Navajo woman to serve in the position.
I think it's just my belief in just making sure the best people are in place and at this moment in time, those types of people are in those positions.
The Navajo Nation Council this year also inaugurated a historic number of women, 9 of 24 delegates. Nygren says he's working closely with the council to address many of the issues facing the tribe, from making sure federal COVID-19 recovery funds are spent to tackling infrastructure needs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Idaho legislature is making another attempt to change the ballot initiative process. Lawmakers are proposing letting voters decide whether to increase the requirements for initiatives to qualify for the ballot. A similar attempt was deemed unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court in 2021. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Idaho lawmakers are attempting to change the ballot initiative process again, this time with an amendment to the state constitution. Senate Joint Resolution 101 would refer a resolution to voters that would require signatures from 6% of registered voters in all 35 Idaho districts to get an initiative on the ballot. It's similar to a measure legislators passed in 2021 that was deemed unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court. Gina Moore with the Ballot Initiative Strategy Center says it will make the process more costly and difficult for grassroots organizations.
What they're trying to do with this bill is make it harder to put these issues on the ballot before voters.
Moore says initiatives are one of the best tools available for passing substantive policies that impact communities. Supporters of the resolution say it would give every district a voice in the initiative process. Opponents claim Idahoans from across the state still are able to approve or disapprove initiatives when they vote on it. Moore says the resolution and others like it that have popped up across the country are not attempts to reform the process or make it more equitable.
It's usually a reaction of trying to undermine the process because they don't like the decision that people in their state have made.
In 2018, the organization Reclaim Idaho succeeded in getting a Medicaid expansion measure on the ballot, which ultimately passed with more than 60% support. In 2019, legislators passed stricter requirements on the expanded program, including work requirements for recipients. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Social media companies are facing scrutiny over cyberbullying and the exploitation of minors tied to their platforms. That coincides with new data regarding internet crimes against children. Officials say there are tips for families to keep kids safe, but they also highlight the need for more resources to investigate claims. Mike Bowen has more on that story in South Dakota.
South Dakota investigators say they're carrying heavy caseloads dealing with internet crimes against children. There's hope new research and pressure from Congress will lead to more tools to protect minors. Last week, a U.S. Senate committee held a hearing involving social media companies, covering topics like cyberbullying and child exploitation. The companies were criticized for putting profits before safety. In South Dakota, Toby Russell of the statewide Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force says platforms, especially newer ones that come on the scene, can provide offenders with new ways to target kids.
We have seen fairly significant increase in online solicitation or enticement type incidents and investigations.
Overall, he says there's been a nearly 200% increase in tips in the last 5 years. And a national study released last fall says 1 in 6 U.S. children have experienced at least one type of sexual abuse online. Meanwhile, Russell says these task forces mostly run on federal grants, which aren't sustainable. There are calls for state lawmakers to provide additional funds. Brent Romer is a retired ICAT commander in South Dakota. He agrees more resources are needed, noting there's a vicious cycle of how tips are circulated. Romer says because of how they're processed through tech companies, there's often little information to go on.
There's still some viable cases that are in there, and there's children that are being abused that are sent through those tips. It's just that law enforcement is bogged down working through some of these tips that aren't as good and still require the same amount of attention.
And the growing caseload and concerns over children's mental health tied to social media platforms have spurred calls for adoption of the federal Kids Online Safety Act. Supporters say would put in place much-needed safeguards. Meanwhile, Russell says there are some ways for families to take action.
Establishing that open line of communication as early as you possibly can, you know, with your children, starting when they're young, and sort of an age-appropriate progression that parents can take with those conversations.
He also suggests parents research apps that can help them monitor their child's online activity. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
Independent farmers and rural communities are concerned about the influence of agribusiness on their bottom line. This has led to a 2,000-plus signature petition being sent to President Joe Biden. It urges him to make good on his 2021 executive order that enforces antitrust laws and promotes competition in the ag industry. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
A petition signed by more than 2,000 farmers, ranchers, and consumers urging enforcement of antitrust laws has been sent to the White House by the Missouri Rural Crisis Center and the Western Organization of Resource Councils. Tim Gibbons with Missouri Rural Crisis Center calls President Joe Biden's 2021 executive order on promoting competition in the American economy a win for independent farming and other industries. He says the petition pushes the president to follow through on his pledge to promote competition in the food and ag industry, especially the livestock market.
To ensure that not only family farmers get paid cost of production and a living wage, but also consumers have access to family farm-raised food.
Gibbons says the trend toward more centralized, multinational, and often foreign control of our food system removes profits from rural communities, costs consumers more, and pays farmers less. The Center for American Progress calls strong antitrust enforcement in the agricultural industry the starting point for protecting farmers and ranchers. In 2022, the agribusiness industry was among the top 10 industries for spending on political lobbying at roughly $125 million. Gibbons says the impact of corporate hog production on Missouri's independent hog producers is a prime example of what independent cattle producers are fighting against.
In one generation, we lost 90% of our hog producers, from 23,000 to the last census, which is just over 2,600. Independent hog production was a huge economic driver in rural Missouri and rural America.
Darvin Bentledge is a fourth-generation farmer and cattle rancher in southwest Missouri. He says he is seeing less and less competition for who he can sell to and who he can buy from.
Fertilizer is heavily concentrated, with actually one company controlling 80% of the phosphorus sales. So they were making record profits while we were lagging behind.
Bentledge believes the impact on farmers' earning potential caused by this decline in competition is one of the reasons fewer young people are choosing a career in farming. He points to the packing industry having made record profits in 2020 and 2021 while farmers were struggling.
We still do not see the prices at the stockyards for feeders. We're still getting paid about $200 less a head than we were in 2014.
For Missouri News Service, I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
While we're on the subject of agriculture, the Biden administration is investing in infrastructure projects for rural America. Democratic strategists say this is part of a mission to reach more folks in those areas. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
Grants for infrastructure projects is one way the Biden administration is getting Democrats' message out to rural Americans. The U.S. Department of Transportation recently touted a dozen projects to improve infrastructure in rural areas. That includes $25 million for improvements in Kalispell, near Glacier National Park. Bill Lombardi has worked for Democratic Senators Max Baucus and John Tester, both of Montana. He says these renovations are important for public safety.
Well, we had a 40-degree below zero cold snap. It was hugely important to make sure those roadways were open, not only for Montanans to shop, but also for utility workers.
Lombardi adds it's important for the Biden administration to let people know what's going on in their communities, and also that these projects bring good-paying jobs. A release from the Department of Transportation notes 13% of rural roads are in poor condition due to decades of divestment, and fatalities are 2 times higher on rural roads than on urban ones. Teresa Purcell was senior advisor for rural engagement for the Democratic Party during the recent midterm elections. She says in some cases, elected officials may not be applying for the grants, so it's important to showcase the grants in order for people to know they are available, awarded, and being utilized.
How are we making sure that those grants are hitting the ground? How are we making sure that, frankly, county commissioners and elected officials who are choosing not to apply for those grants are held accountable to turning away money that will actually help their communities thrive?
Purcell notes that many of the needs are basic when it comes to transportation in rural areas.
We're just trying to get gravel, and folks are talking about mass transit. We need to make sure that people are really listening to the needs of the community, because that is often missing.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Your You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Monday, February 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News in Depth. Have a great night.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking today with Mel Gerdoff, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Portland State University. He has been a visiting professor and senior Fulbright scholar at the Waseda University in Tokyo and the Hankook Foreign Studies University in Seoul. In addition to his teaching duties, Dr. Gerdoff served a 23-year stint as the senior editor of Asian Perspective, an international quarterly covering topics of international relations and foreign policy. Dr. Gerdoff has published more than 25 books and numerous articles. We will be discussing today his newest book, entitled Engaging China, Rebuilding Sino-American Relations, out now through Roman and Littlefield Publishing.